Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an unspeakable violence conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Unspeakable violence, as in stabbing someone to death and having no recollection or control of what happened, as in becoming possessed and hallucinating after using a drug that turns you into a different person. In 2018, a 28-year-old professional audiologist, Bryn Spacer, was on a date with 26-year-old accountant Chad Omelia. Chad was a regular marijuana user with a large bong displayed. Bryn inhaled the THC from the bong and within minutes became psychotic. Having severe hallucinations, Bryn stabbed Chad 108 times using kitchen knives. She also stabbed her beloved service dog and then repeatedly stabbed herself in the neck, nearly killing herself. She would be dead if police officers did not arrive on scene and intervene, hitting her several times with their baton to knock the knife out of her hand. All the experts and forensic psychiatrists on the prosecution and defense side of Bryn's trial agreed that marijuana caused Bryn's psychosis that led to violence. She had cannabis-induced psychosis. The Bryn Spacer's trial was a landmark case proving the association of marijuana with psychosis and violence. I discussed the Bryn Spacer manslaughter case of Chad Omelia on previous episodes of High Truths. On episode 163, I spoke with Heidi Swan and Dr. Christy Brown, who attended Bryn's trial and discussed it. On episode 172, I spoke with Eve Simmons, a reporter from the Daily Mail, who reported on the trial and empathized with Bryn. In this episode, we learned about unspeakable violence associated with marijuana, straight from the source, someone with lived experience, Bryn Spacer herself. Bryn Spacer has a PhD in audiology. Her life stopped and changed directions after her violent episode with marijuana and charges of involuntary manslaughter of Chad Omelia. Accompanying Bryn is Audrey Adams. She is supervising Bryn's court-ordered community service hours. This episode of High Truths counts for those hours. Aubrey Adams is the founder and director of Every Brain Matters, a nationally trusted educational resource formed by families with loved ones whose lives were damaged or ended by marijuana. Every Brain Matters has a memorial to the many lives lost to marijuana. Aubrey hosts her own podcast, It's Just Pot, What's the Problem? She returns to High Truths from episode 170. To learn more about Bryn Spacer and Audrey Adams, check out the High Truths show notes. I recorded this conversation on July 8th, 2025. Bryn Spacer, Mom Lori Pierce, and Aubrey Adams, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So thank you so much. I know this is a difficult subject, a hard matter, and I really appreciate you going through this again with us on this podcast, really for the purpose of education and making sure this doesn't happen to other people. And I think that that's why your story is very important. Let's start with a few sentences just to introduce yourself from each of you. Bryn, let's start with you.
Yeah, my name is Bryn Spacer. I'm from Illinois and I am an audiologist. And I also survived cannabis-induced psychosis 7 years ago.
I like how you say that, you survived it. And Lori.
I'm Lori Pierce. I am Bryn's mom, also living in Illinois, and I work at the public middle school in the administration office.
Nice. And Aubrey.
Hi, my name is Aubrey Adams. I'm the director of Every Brain Matters, and we are helping Bryn provide education on cannabis-induced psychosis. And thank you for having us here today.
Thanks. And Bryn, I want to ask you, I want us to really start out with how comfortable you are in doing this podcast. I know since, the trauma that you've survived, is it easier each time you tell your story, or is it still hard to do?
I think it's not always easy sharing a traumatic story, especially if it's about violence, a death, drugs, psychosis, and especially if it's something I don't really remember much of. But obviously in the last 7 years since the incident, I've gone through a lot of therapy and being on medication that have helped me get through the years and the stories and the repetitiveness and, just helping cope with my symptom to be able to handle this story a little bit better over time. If we're talking like 6 years ago, I couldn't even think about it about the story, and I would just be sobbing. Now, the fact that I have a little bit, time has passed, and I have a little bit more strength to educate and spread awareness of this story, it has gotten a little easier, but I hate doing it. I hate talking about this story. It's just traumatic all over.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes reliving things is not comfortable. I understand that. So during this podcast, at any point you feel uncomfortable, you don't want to go there, just tell me and we'll redirect. Because I know this is our second time trying to do that. And the first time it didn't go well, and we stopped. I didn't want you to traumatize you. And now we have your mom here, so hopefully that'll be better. And let me ask you, Lori, the same question. This is, it's Bryn's trauma, but you too. I mean, trauma affects the whole family. Is it easier for you? Is it reliving, bad moments each time?
Well, it didn't happen to me firsthand. So I have wanted to be and still want to be available to Bryn to support her, and on bad days and good days to continue to bolster her in, what she has to accomplish right now, and to have a future, because it's so easy to get stuck in the middle of this. It's so devastating and overwhelming. It's something that we have never had any contact with in our lives. And so, you just try and get through each day separately. You can't plan too much, and you can't hope too much. You just gotta get through the day you're in. Mm-hmm.
Can I just say how beautiful it is to have your mom support you, even when you're an adult woman? I know I'm an adult, I'm a grandma, and my mom still supports me. So to have that, I think, is really beautiful. Lucky.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very fortunate to have her.
Let's talk about your life before May 28th, 2018. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and what kind of girl you were.
Yeah, I was fortunate to grow up in a healthy, loving home. Felt very safe. We were not violent towards each other. Me and my brothers were all involved in like sports, music, church, school. I did Girl Scouts, dance, all kinds of stuff. And I was also overcoming the challenge of being diagnosed with sensory neural hearing loss. So I've utilized hearing aids now over 30 years, and just trying to keep up with my peers, especially during childhood. And then I started caring more about my career and what I wanted to do, and went through college and graduate school to become an audiologist to help others who also have hearing issues or need hearing aids. Any way I could help with children or people of all ages. I found my passion in undergrad school, and it's very eye-opening, and I was very excited, looking forward to that career path. And then...
Grad school, where'd you go to grad school?
I went to Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and got my doctorate in 2017.
And when did you move to California?
I moved to California in August of 2017 when I got a job offer with UCLA, particularly in the outside clinic in Thousand Oaks, California. And I also worked at the Los Angeles location at House Children's Hearing Center of UCLA. And I knew this team before when I did an internship a different summer, like 2015 or something like that. So I kind of knew them already from doing a short summer internship. It was awesome.
Nice. And what's your experience with drugs before that day? Have you?
Growing up in Illinois, I know it's very different than the culture in California, but in Illinois, like back in the day in the 90s, like they generalized like all drugs are bad. But then over time, you know, you start to see some movies and shows that portray likable stoner characters. And then pop culture, they glamorized and normalized cannabis use. And even musicians, celebrities were giving that cool image and without, you know, without any consequences. And then I started seeing my some high school friends smoking, but I never participated in it. Because I was always against doing things illegally. So I never did drugs illegally. So the first time I tried it was in 2016 when I was in Washington camping with a former boyfriend. And we tried a joint. And all I knew back then was the difference between sativa and indica, from what others have told me. And the only reaction I had was just the munchies and the giggles, like as expected from just what I knew growing up. And then it wasn't until 2017, 2018, when I was in California, where it was legal. And I did a handful of other times of cannabis use. So whether it was a joint, a pipe, an edible, a pop brownie, or a bong. Again, all of it was provided by trusted friends. I never bought it. I never owned anything. I never prepared anything. It was always provided to me. And I just saw it as like a social use, because now that it's legal, just like drinking, that, you know, oh, you know, do you want a drink? Sure, I'll take a drink. Do you want a hit? Okay, yeah, I'll take a hit. Because our parents' generations, they all took a joint and like passed it around each other. Like it was like for social reasons.
Your mom is in the background saying, not my generation. What do you?
I don't know. But just from watching like the media and how they, you know, would share cannabis use with each other's friends. And like everybody was just more relaxed. Like to me, I just thought, oh, it's not that big of a deal. It's harmless. I never saw red flags from marijuana use.
I think what you say is very important. It gives us a perspective, you know, of a child too. Like, you're not supposed to do this, so you never did. And then when, well, everybody else is doing it and it becomes normalized, then, you know, then why not try it? But Lori, you were shaking your head. Tell us what you were thinking.
Well, you know, I might have had a different background. I'd gone to Christian schools my whole life, all the way through part of college. And that was just not done. There was, you know, it was not a thing that we had in our house. It was not a thing that I was even exposed to as a child or a young adult. So, you know, we talked about it, but I was no authority of any kind to explain, you know, all the details about it. So, you know, yeah. I wish I had been. I might have been a little bit more, made everybody scared. I don't know. What would you have done?
Yeah. And you're, what you know is what you're told around you. And I mean, I think what you're told in your childhood and the perspectives was right, and it gave you deterrence. And then that social pressure is real. Did you feel social pressure? Like everybody's doing, I should like try it, you know, like if you're at a party and everybody's holding a glass of alcohol, how could you not?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, because I was trying to learn more about the California culture of cannabis, and my best friends were doing it, and it was like, oh, well, maybe this would be another way to relax or be social or hang out. All those times I did choose to try it, mm-hmm. and they were very, you know, they were in support of me. It wasn't like they were being mean about it or making fun of me or anything. They were, you know, I don't think I ever really felt pressured from my best friends during those handful of times. But, you know, again, it was like something that I wasn't completely interested in. And if it was just there, maybe I'd try it. But it wasn't like, oh, you're, I love it so much, I'm going to go buy it myself now. Like, it wasn't a thing for me.
Lori, anything you want to add about childhood?
You know, she had a birth trauma. She had aspirated meconium as a fetus, as a full-term 9-pound fetus, and was not able to breathe after that first breath into her lungs. They weren't able to function. So she was helicoptered to Children's Memorial, now Lurie Children's in Chicago. And it was on a respirator for a week. So, you know, after that week, they told us, well, she could be brain damaged. She could not be able to walk. She could be blind. Nobody ever mentioned the auditory nerve, but, you know, they were trying to save her life. And so we waited to see what would happen once they took her off the oxygen. And so, you know, I was just glad she survived it all and was doing all the things developmentally that her older brother was doing until about the age of 2.5, 3. I wasn't able to understand what she was saying. And I thought, well, I don't want to compare kids, you know, she, whatever. So it wasn't until I called up the hospital and said, did she have a hearing test before she left? And they're like, oh, no. She fell through the cracks. And so I'm like, okay, take her to an audiologist. And she came out and said, well, she has a moderate to severe sensory neural hearing loss in both ears and will wear hearing aids the rest of her life. So that was devastating, but I got all the information I could. And I decided that she needed to learn how to listen and speak instead of doing signing, because she could always learn that, and she needed to hear whatever she had left to be able to speak and use the residual hearing.
And we, right now, we wouldn't know that you have an issue with that at all. And it sounds like you grew up with despite that handicap, Girl Scouts, sports, friends, just like any other child, right?
Well, it was all the motivation to get her around speaking and hearing kids, mm-hmm. so that she was learning language. You know, if a child isn't around an adult all the time, they're not going to learn language like a child. They need to be around other children. So I just started putting her in everything. I had her start the flute because it's a high frequency sound. And lo and behold, she had talent. She got a music scholarship to college. But so I just put her in dance and sports and, you know, everything I could find to develop that hearing and that speech. Plus, we did auditory verbal training, which I found out about. We continue to do that to this day, really, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she grew up learning as a hearing impaired child learns. It's different. Their perspective is different. What they hear is different. You know, you don't slap on a pair of hearing aids and then she hears like you and me. It's a mechanical sound, and there are sounds missing still.
Yeah.
So, and I taught teaching the audiologist all about
You're
this.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, yeah. That obviously stayed with you because you wanted to really learn and get a doctorate degree in it.
Well, at the time I didn't like seeing those doctors because it was taking me away from like my friends and like what they were doing and why am I the only one seeing this hearing doctor, and getting your hearing tested in the booth was annoying and long.
And the FM system. Yeah.
And then I had the FM system in school as part of my IEP plans, where the teacher would wear a microphone and the receiver would be attached to my hearing aids. So I would hear just the teacher into my ears a lot louder, instead of like being distracted with outside classroom noise, like from other kids or papers. And so it was obvious that all these kids knew that the teacher was wearing this microphone because of me. And I was the only hearing impaired student growing up for so long. So, you know, there's that little insecurity as a kid. You're like, you know, why am I the only one? Why is it, you know, why me? Why, whatever. And then in high school, yeah, I ended the FM system because, you know, it's high school, you're all teenagers and you're trying to fit in. And again, there was like no one else with hearing aids. So I was just trying to be as normal as I could by joining, you know, the basketball team, volleyball, playing the flute, getting good grades, doing all the things I could, just like everybody else.
You also learned how to advocate for yourself and find that spot in the class where you could hear and see. And it was a constant struggle every single day. Everybody looks at her and goes, oh, she's so great. You wouldn't even know that she, well, but she worked her ass off. And she's, sorry, and she still is.
Yeah, I see that. Let's transition now to a darker time, the dark day. Bryn, tell us, what do you remember of that day?
Well, the majority of the day, I was spending some time with two other girlfriends up like an hour north of where I live. And it was a normal day. We went to the beach. We went out to eat. We were just hanging out, catching up. And it was really fun hanging out with those girls. And then at night, last minute, I ended up going to my friend's house. And again, it was, you know, because there was no work the next day, it wasn't like I had to go to bed early. So I would just, you know, catch up with my friend. And like previous times, we were catching up on our weekend. We were laughing about random stuff. We were just, it was just normal at his condo. And he said that he needed to go smoke outside on his porch. All of his products were outside on the porch.
This is Chad, right?
Yes. So I joined him because I know he smokes for a while. And we were just talking, being social. And I asked for the first hit, I asked if I could take one, just because, I don't know, he's just doing it. I wish I didn't, but, you know, as expected, I was just coughing, like, you know, this is so stupid. And he's laughing at me, telling me the proper way to inhale, like just stupid stuff like that. And then we continued talking for a little bit, and I, you know, he was telling me how high he was feeling. And I, you know, responded like, oh, like, I never feel very high. It's very minimal for me. If not, I barely get reaction from cannabis use. So he was aware of my naive experiences. And he eventually says, well, we'll make this next one really intense. And him being a sarcastic guy and always joking around, like, honestly, I didn't even know what that meant. Whether he was joking or not, I'm like, what does that mean? And mind you, everything's happening pretty fast. So as he's preparing it, I could tell it was a few seconds longer. But it was the same way he prepared it from the first time. So I'm like, what? what kind of, like, why would this be more intense? Again, and everything was happening so fast. So the only thing I noticed was that the chamber became more white. There was like there was more smoke in there. And then within, you know, a few seconds, he turned the bong around, rushed it in my face and pressured me into taking it, saying, you know, hurry up, hurry up. And, you know, feeling pressured, I just decided to inhale it because I wish I didn't, but I take responsibility for inhaling that hit, but not knowing what he did at the time. And immediately I could tell this was so much stronger. The coughing was harder. I was crying. I felt like I was vomiting. Like there was smoke like something was in my throat choking me that I needed to vomit. And I immediately stumbled my way to the bathroom and trying to reduce these symptoms, drink some water, which wasn't working. And then I could tell the room was starting to spin and I was starting to feel really dizzy. So then I went to go lay on the couch, not feeling well. He was like in my face, trying to pour water in my face and other things. And it just was a lot. It was a lot. And so I remember trying to have like a conversation with him because he's like laughing in the kitchen, telling me how high I was. And I'm trying to like produce these logical words and sentences, but I knew it wasn't coming out the right way I wanted it to. So eventually he told me to fall asleep. And then this is when these next phases were happening. And the first part of the phase, I was just kind of seeing some weird images, weird sound. It felt like hours. I didn't know what I was looking at. I didn't know why I wasn't waking up like we would in a nightmare. I didn't know if I was dead. I was so confused and scared. Like, I didn't know what was going on. And then what solidified the thought of me being dead was that I was seeing images of like this out of body experience, seeing my dead body on the porch and people crying and ambulance there. And that's when I thought that, oh my gosh, I'm dead. And then I saw like another visual of like a funeral and like my mom's hands touching my hands. And like, I was being touched, you know, all over. It was like, so then this next phase, it was like watching a TV screen and I had no control, but I also had no thoughts or emotions or sense of morality or sense of motor movements. I was impervious to pain. There was nothing there. It was just like I was just blankly watching all these images happening in front of me. And it would black out intermittently. So, and I was watching all these horrible images. And I don't want to get into those details because it was so awful.
You don't have to.
And again, like there was no thought of like, what am I doing? This is wrong. Like, just stop. Like there was none of that. It was just like watching a horror movie happen. And I saw bad things happening to Chad and then my dog. And then I was also hurting myself. And I was also hearing voices at one point saying like, you know, don't stop, keep going. You're almost there. I don't know what that meant, you know. But it was like the louder I screamed or the louder I was hurting myself, it was like I was about to wake up, like a bright light was coming. And I was starting to see like doctors in an OR room saying, you can do this. You got this. Like they're rescuing me or something. And when I was hurting myself, it felt like 1,000 bullets a second, but I thought it was like the doctors using a defibrillator to wake me up. So, and after about a couple of those, I blacked out and I don't remember anything after that until I woke up in the hospital.
So you don't remember the police there or anything like that?
No, I don't remember the police there. I don't remember the being in the ambulance. I don't remember being in the hospital surgery. I mean, I remember an image. I remember waking up in the emergency OR room with, and I can tell there was a little bit more sense of reality with people around my body and the doctor asking me something, but you know, I still didn't know what was going on. And then the next time I woke up was in the ICU room and I was intubated. My arms were in casts. There's people in the room. I was just so confused and scared. Like, I didn't even know why I was there, how I was there, what happened to me. And then as I'm waking up in the ICU room, all those images were coming through. And so
those same images you were seeing again?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I was starting to be more conscious of like these images of what I saw and witnessed. And so, you know, I was feeling so scared and not sure what was going on. And I, you know, the first thing I asked was, you know, I wrote down, because I couldn't talk, I wrote down, you know, was it rape? Like, was it like a self-defense thing? And then I'm asking like, well, where's Chad? Where is he? Like, is he in the room next door? Because if I'm alive, he probably is too, you know, it's like, I don't know. Or what happened to a dog that got hurt? And nobody was answering any of these questions.
Could you tell what was real and what wasn't real? Like of your images, what was really happening and what was just part of your psychosis?
I didn't know what psychosis was at the time. And so I didn't know what was real, what was not, what was, I don't know. Again, I wasn't sure what I witnessed. So after being in the hospital and I realized I was being interviewed by detectives and they, after a few days later, they finally told me that Chad had passed. And I just couldn't believe it because because I still wasn't sure what happened, how that happened, what happened to him, why did he survive this? You know, and that I am not a violent person. I would never do this to anybody. I also didn't even know this interview was real. Like I had to ask them like my name and my birthday to make sure like what I was dealing with right now was actually real because something I've never done.
I'm so sorry. Let me pivot to give you a chance to kind of catch up. Lori, when did you see your daughter intubated in the ICU?
I saw her intubated when I first saw her, when she was born intubated. But this incident, I think the tube was out by the time I got there.
Yeah. And what did you think when you heard this?
I had no idea. You know, she didn't know to even tell me. And, you know, I had no ideas of what my first thought was. This guy attacked her. That's what I thought, because she had told me recently that she basically didn't want to date him anymore. You know, guys don't like rejection, I don't think, especially when they want to keep dating the girl, the woman. So that's what I thought, is that he tried to attack her, assault her, rape her, and she fought back.
Who told you about this violence? Did Bryn or did the detectives? I mean, that must have been like, what are you talking about?
I got a call from the hospital at home. Bryn was supposed to come home in 2 days. My other sons were home for my youngest to graduate from high school. We were all going to go to the high school graduation.
Yeah.
So I was in the car when I got a call from the hospital saying, did you know your daughter was involved in an incident where somebody died? And I'm like, what? So that's pretty much all she told me. And we all got on a plane to California. And when I got there, I wasn't told too much. Just a lot of interview questions about Bryn, you know, and her violent background. It's like, there is no violent background. She doesn't have any background like that at all. So it was a lot of stuff that they didn't understand. How come she's still alive? How'd she make it? You know, is what they wanted. They couldn't figure it out either. The cops couldn't figure it out. Detectives.
Why she lived, but it's clear why you lived. I mean, from what you're telling me, that you started to, you would have died if they didn't come and knock the knife away from you.
Yeah. I later found out that when police intervened, they had a gun pointing at me, but instead they decided to attempt tasing me, and they tased me about 4 times, and it was unsuccessful. And so then a police officer used his baton and struck me like 9 times to get the knife out of my hand. I have no recollection of this. Again, I was impervious to pain as one of the symptoms.
Your arm broke, right?
My shoulder's permanently injured. My left hand and arm had broken bones, and then I had lacerations in my right hand and face and neck. But
we didn't know how that had happened.
Yeah.
Now we do, but we had no idea. She's going to all these appointments to fix stuff, and they're asking her, well, how did this happen to you? And we would be like, we don't know. You know what I mean? It's like, what, are we going to go into the whole story? It's like, it was awful. We had no idea. We didn't know until years later, I think. It was...
Wow. What do you remember? Sorry, hospitalized, things are confused. It sounds like, even though the psychosis may have been over, differentiating what's real and not real took a few days.
Yeah, it took, she still doesn't know what was real and what wasn't real. Because when you're in a psychosis, what's happening is not necessarily, what you think is happening is not necessarily what's real. You know what I'm saying? So even her testimony is possible that those things didn't even happen, or other things were happening that she didn't remember. So
like, for example, like I remember seeing a brown dog get hurt, and I thought it was Chad's dog because he had a German Shepherd. But I later found out that it was my dog, Aria, who's a black and white husky that got hurt.
So that wasn't even her perception. She had no idea Aria was even anything. She had to be told. I mean, so all of this stuff, nobody really knows what really happened and what didn't until you get a few more facts. But even then, we don't know what Chad was doing to her. We don't know.
We'll never know what his intentions were. And unfortunately, and I even did smoke the same bong with him like a week prior to this event. So there was that trust factor already of like, oh, like this is not a big deal, you know, with this accessory, I guess. But I also later found out that, you know, Chad also did this to his roommate. He did this, whatever this was, to his roommate a couple weeks ago.
And what do you mean by this?
Well, backtracking, when I was in the hospital and then I was being interviewed by the detectives, they ended up arresting me for first degree murder. And so I had to be sent to the jail. And I was in there for like 6 days until I was released on bail. And then we were trying out the public defender. And a year later, you know, we realized that in the preliminary hearing that there was only THC in my system. And, you know, just like everybody else, it's like, how would there be only THC? Because the detectives thought it might have been laced with Lanax. I'm sorry. The detectives thought it might have been laced with Xanax because it was at the scene. And we were like, that would have made so much sense because I'm used to hearing stories about people getting drugged. But that wasn't the case. So when my toxicology report came out, it was THC only. So we're now even more confused. How could THC cause this type of reaction? I've never heard of this reaction. So did everybody else. I was just like the rest of the public. There's no way.
I'm wondering, I didn't see the toxicology report, and I know that there's variations from different labs on how they do it. I'm wondering if they tested it for the intoxicating hemp products like Delta 10, Delta 8, or bath salts or something else, or if that was not included. I mean, there may have been
I think Delta 8 and THC were evaluated, but I don't have the reports in front of me. That would be a better question for my lawyers.
I think they had only so much blood to test, and they only had so many tests that they could accomplish.
They could have tested Chad.
Yeah.
And
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't
know. But that would, I mean, without looking, just as a physician, it'd be interesting if they did a real complete toxicology report on Chad, at least.
And they might have, but he wasn't on trial, so I don't think they had to produce stuff, did they?
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a question from my lawyers.
Yeah. Not lawyers, but as a physician, like understanding what happened to you, to do that.
Well,
nobody wanted to understand what happened to her, I don't think, mm-hmm. really.
So a few years later, when we eventually had to hire criminal defense attorneys privately, it was 3 years later after the incident that they showed me articles about drug-induced psychosis, specifically cannabis. And so we're kind of like, well, this is new. Like now we're learning about this. This kind of makes more sense, but never heard of it before. Never heard of stories like this before. And so then we started talking to a lot of different professionals and experts who knew about this. And I was meeting some of those experts to be evaluated by them. And I've talked to multiple experts for the defense, but I also talked to an expert by the prosecution. And in all of the reports, they unanimously decided that this was solely due to cannabis-induced psychosis and that I don't have any history of mental illness before or even after the incident. Of course, I have, you know, symptoms of PTSD since then, but they all said that this is due to cannabis-induced psychosis based on all the evidence, based on the footage, based on
multiple psychiatrist evaluation.
So now this was going to be a big thing in my case, and that alone convinced the district attorney's office to downgrade my charge to involuntary manslaughter for the trial, which was then going to be happening in a month following.
Were you in jail all this time?
No, I was on bail.
Okay, so you didn't have to spend a lot of time in jail.
When I got arrested, I was only in jail for about 6 days.
I just want to clarify. Just clarify that Brynn's full toxicology report was only THC. There was no bath salts. There was no other drugs in her system. It was pure, only THC. So I just want to make sure that the previous conversation that the viewers really understand that part. So thank you for letting me chime in.
No, and Aubrey, while you're chiming in, we can give them a little break here. And First of all, Bryn is so articulate in describing what psychosis is, because you're right. When we tell people you have psychosis or say, you know, cannabis can give you psychosis, people don't know what it means. And Bryn, thank you for your story, because you, and I know we see that it's hard for you to do, but you really explain so well what that means. And so many things about your childhood and social pressure and stuff really gives a description of why, for some people, cannabis could be very dangerous. But Aubrey, what do you think? You've been with Bryn now for a long time, and now you're hearing her tell her story again. What strikes you?
Well, you know, we were interested in Bryn's story way back when it happened. Our friend Lori Robinson, who started one of the first parent advocacy groups on the harms of cannabis, especially cannabis-induced psychosis, she lives in Thousand Oaks, California. So she said, look at this. Look what happened to this couple this night. This is that they used cannabis and it ended up very tragically. And she, you know, in her gut feeling was like, this was a cannabis-induced psychosis episode. So we watched Bryn. We watched the news articles. We didn't know Bryn at the time. And when we saw Bryn's trial coming, we had advocates in the courtroom. Her court was not live streamed. So we wanted to know the details of that night and to see, was it really cannabis-induced psychosis? What happened that night? And 100%, there was no other factors involved. And so we're watching, you know, we have Heidi, our friend Heidi Anderson Swan, and Dr. Christy Brown in the courtroom taking detailed notes and listening to both sides of the trial, the prosecuting team and the defense team, and just witnessing what was happening, because we are all families impacted by cannabis-induced psychosis. Most of our stories are very horrific, nothing compared to what Bryn and her family went through and what Chad and his family went through. But we are very aware that this is happening every day throughout the country because of the normalization and the promotion of this drug and the lack of knowledge around it. So when Bryn was convicted and sentenced, one of her sentencing was 100 hours of community education about the harms of THC. And so we approached Bryn, and we were, I was like, how is she going to do this? Like, how is she going to tell her story 100 times and provide this very valuable information that can really possibly save lives? You know, this is critical information. What she survived that night, most people don't survive. And so then she's dealing with the trauma of it and just the heaviness of that she is this survivor and she has this life-saving story to tell. We got involved because we approached her and said, well, how are you going to do this over and over? So we've been in conversations with her and her probation officers about how to effectively do this without her mental well-being deteriorating, that she can survive the community education hours that she's court ordered to provide now. And so Every Brain Matters got involved, Heidi and I got involved in to provide support for her and to get her into key locations of people that really want to educate about the true harms of cannabis. And I think too, like just to add to that story, you know, when Bryn put the bong to her mouth that night, when Chad gave her the bong that night, neither one of them knew that this could happen. And this is the public disservice that is happening in our country. People do not know the power of the plant. They do not know that THC can induce such an acute psychotic episode that it can end so tragically, not just for one family, but for two families. And now both of these families, the people that were in the condo that night, they're all traumatized for the rest of their lives. And they're all trying to figure out how to process and accept what happened and survive it. And so I just to wrap up kind of a view here, this is not an isolated incident. We are blessed that Bryn is here with us and is so articulate, intelligent young lady who can provide this critical information. So my organization and my network of people, what we want to do is continue to support her the best we can, so she can tell her story in the most effective way and let people know that marijuana is not less harmful than other drugs. What they were consuming that night is not medicine. That the promotion, the normalization of this drug is dangerous. And it can end with losing lives. And that is a disservice because we don't even track marijuana-related deaths. You know, when I go do education, people say to me, well, nobody dies from marijuana. Well, I'm like, well, have you heard of the Bryn Spacier case and what happened to her friend that night? You know, we are very proud of Bryn and Lori coming forward. And thank you, Dr. Love, for having them on. We know your podcast will reach a broad audience and provide critical information. And then I'll just wrap it up by saying, too, and thank you for letting me have this time to speak. You know, our hearts go out, not just to the O'Malley family, but to the Spacier family. They both have suffered greatly throughout the years, and it's been an honor and a privilege to get to know the Spacier family. And we hope in time that more families like them come forward. So the weight just isn't on Bryn's shoulders, but we can have a collective audience. And that is starting to happen. We do have more families coming forward and sharing their stories. So thank you for letting me speak. And I just want to say how proud we are of the courage and strength Bryn has and her mom has to share today.
No, thank you. And thank you, Aubrey, for, you know, speaking the science and the real stories from people that's not always popular, and making this connection. And Aubrey, this is personal for you, too, in your family.
Yeah, it is very personal to me. I live with the harms of marijuana with my loved ones every day. And I'm watching one of my loved ones try to recover right now, wanting to get help. And it's a suffering. It's nothing compared to Bryn's story. But we've had incidents that could have ended like Bryn's that had the same outcomes as Bryn. And there's a collective group of families that are really trying to do our best to bring awareness and education. And it's hard. And I could just sob right now. You know, I've been doing this for many years. So when I see Bryn and share her story and I know what I'm doing on a daily basis, it's just a deep sadness that we all carry because all of this is preventable. And we don't need to pass policies or have advertisements for drugs that cause such great harm. And so that's why we have Every Brain Matters. We're just a grassroots nonprofit full of families that have been harmed by THC, and it is personal, and we want to do whatever we can to stop this nightmare from happening to other families.
Yeah, a growing number of families. You know, I got into this back in the prescription opioid epidemic when I, as a physician, was a supplier of drugs, and families were growing and angry, and we didn't even know that as a medical community. And now there's a huge amount of families affected by fentanyl, but I think the families affected by cannabis, and Bryn and Lori, you guys are one of them, but you're not alone. But that is growing, and it's just a matter of time before it's more people know about that. I just wanted to share you guys also that this is not a rare thing, because people, oh, this is such a, you know, this horrific case and got media attention. But in my practice as an emergency physician, I see cannabis-induced psychosis on a regular basis. You know, during the same time that this has happened to you, I treated a woman who came in the emergency department with her boyfriend. And she was looking around, couldn't make eye contact, in a psychosis. And when she didn't Her boyfriend just said she had something wrong with her. She didn't even know what. And I looked at her arms and they were slashed and her neck was slashed. And now she became a trauma patient instead of a mental health patient because of the, you know, her injuries to her neck. And then her boyfriend said something like, she felt like she had to do this in order to save me. You know, it's not exactly like your story, but there's similar concepts. And so we see that there is one of the very first podcasts I ever listened to was a wonderful series called Serial. And in one of them, a man named Adnan Syed was convicted of killing his girlfriend, Haemin Lee, in 1999. And he sat in jail for 30 plus years, but he swears he had no recollection of what happened. And nowhere in the, I'm listening to this podcast, waiting them to mention his marijuana use. Then nobody ever brought that up or said anything. That was back in 1999. I think if it happened today, it would have been differently. But we're seeing this on a regular basis, and I just wanted to share that with you. And I want to ask you guys what you have learned about marijuana since this, and I assume it's probably a continuing growing learning that you're doing.
Well, before this happened, you know, I thought marijuana was safe and harmless. Even if it was illegal, I wasn't seeing anything bad from it. But and I believed those myths, that it was just for relaxation and something to do socially, and that it wasn't addictive, and that no one gets hurt. Now I know how wrong that is. And it was one night with a friend being social, and it destroyed everything. My life, his life, all of our loved ones involved in this. Marijuana today is nothing like it was decades ago. The THC levels are dangerously high, especially in concentrates. And I also learned that marijuana-induced psychosis is not rare, like you said. It's just underreported or misunderstood, or no one wants to talk about it, or they're not around to talk about it. People think cannabis is harmless because it's natural or legal, but it can have a profound effects on brain chemistry, especially in young adults and children.
And you taught me something, Bryn, stacking. I never heard of that until you described that. Can you tell us what that is, like what you said, what he did to that? And that, I think it was a stacking, and you, can you explain that?
Yeah, this was explained by Dr. Dan Buffington. He's a pharmacologist in Tampa, Florida, and he was an expert that testified at the trial. And from my understanding, stacking hits, also known as layering a bong, is when someone takes multiple inhalations of marijuana smoke from the bong. So they're adding multiple doses with their mouth covered. They're adding multiple doses as they keep burning the leaves. And they're holding the smoke in the chamber, and then you just inhale it all at once. So it's not just one dose, but we're talking several doses, which is why a chamber would look more white or opaque. And it's meant to intensify the high and increase THC absorption. And unfortunately, this kind of technique can overwhelm the brain, especially with potent THC. And in my case, it triggered a complete psychotic break. So let's say it's like 12%. You're not just doing it just one time, but you're adding 12%, 12%, 12%. So you're just exponentially increasing that dose, and then you inhale it all at once. It's like taking a 500 milligram pill versus a 5 milligram pill that you should be prescribed of. Obviously, it's going to affect your body much differently, and it's going to be more overwhelming that your body is not going to be able to handle.
And maybe that's why you've used marijuana in the past and didn't have such effect, but this time, boom.
Mm-hmm. Especially for a naive user, especially, you know, I don't know.
And Lori, what about you? What have you learned?
Well, listening to your stories of the emergency room, I'm wondering, where are those statistics? Where are all the stories? Where's the compilation of these same effects from marijuana use. I don't know. I just feel like people aren't going to believe it until all of these incidents come together and the arrow is pointed at THC, regular marijuana use.
Yeah.
And all these techniques that people know about. You know, I have to argue with Aubrey. I think Chad knew about this because he had done it before. The one time we know of was documented in the courtroom, and he knew what the effect was, and he was trying it out on somebody else. And, you know, the danger of that just for fun, for a good time, doesn't end up that way.
And that's what makes me want to advocate my story, because there's so many young kids that could be in that similar scenario, or they're just doing it because to be cool, or they're pressured into something, or they don't know what they're taking. They're buying whatever at the dispensary stores and they don't know what's going to happen to them. So
there are no statistics. There's no stuff out there that people can read and do research on to make a good decision.
Yeah. I think, Lori, you are saying exactly what I say. The first thing we need is data, and you can't be hiding the data. And yes. and we're not doing that. And it reminds me of the tobacco days when people say, well, nobody dies of tobacco. Nobody dies of one puff of tobacco. And that sounds ridiculous today.
Right. It wasn't until the Surgeon General came out and talked about it and said, this is the cause of cancer because of all this data that we put together. Finally, decades, hundreds of years. I don't know. And is it going to take that long for marijuana to put, you know, pregnant women shouldn't drink alcohol on the bottles? You know, how long did that take?
Yeah. Do you still have questions about, I mean, the data point? You're spot on, Lori, exactly. But any other that you wish you knew or need to know? Or,
you know, I don't know. I just think that experienced users have a responsibility. If that's what they're going to live with, they have a responsibility not to hurt other people with it.
Outcomes. And maybe this is too hard a question, but who's to blame for this tragedy? And let me start with Aubrey. I'll make it easy. Aubrey.
Who's to blame? Our government, the legislators, the people who sell the product and don't tell the truth about the product, the users who live in a state of delusion and denial that marijuana causes psychosis and violence. They deny that. They laugh at us. They mock us on a daily basis. They tell people that we're lying and our stories aren't true. So, you know, we are interested in advocating for lawsuits to hold people accountable, because the legislators are not following the science. They're not following the data, the poor collection of the data that we have so far. How dare a government in a country let a drug be promoted as safe in medicine without even having a systematic data collection in place to inform the public and the taxpayers who voted in this drug of the real harms. So there's a lot to blame here. I want to add too that some people make some nasty comments to me that Bryn didn't have a harsher sentence, and they're mad at me about that. I'm like, why are you mad at me about that? You know, why are you mad at Bryn about that? You know, the judge was there, heard both sides of the story, made his decision. He earned that position as the judge. I said, why don't you turn that anger back on you? Why are you allowing this drug in your community to be promoted as natural and harmless in medicine? You know, why aren't you doing your civic duty and taking the responsibility to inform our legislators? So why aren't you joining me? Why are you fighting me? Why are you blaming me? You think I have some kind of magic wand that I can just change everything, you know, just us by ourselves? And it's not. So, you know, in the end, really, shame on this country, shame on our legislators for the ones that are ignoring the science and the real outcomes of this, and putting public health and safety at risk and ruining lives. I really don't hold back when I do my advocacy work or education, as you can tell. I'm a truth teller. This is a nightmare for my family and many more, and especially the Spacier family. So what's the answer? I'm just going to keep doing what I do to raise a network of people. We're battling the hemp THC industry in Texas right now. And none of it's fun. It's very emotionally exhausting. It's very abusive for me and the families that I'm working with to try to get the legislators and the governor of Texas to understand how horrific THC really is for people of all ages. There's this lack of awareness that it's only harmful for youth. Bryn was 27 or 28 years old with a fully developed brain, bright, intelligent young lady. If it can happen to her, it can happen to anybody. So my plea is to Governor Abbott and to the state legislators in Texas, protect your people from this terrible drug. Don't allow it to be promoted in your communities. Don't allow this industry to continue to get away with false narratives and impersonating medical professionals. We are losing a lot of lives, and it's not fun.
You know, it's a risk factor. And to make the tobacco analogy again, not everybody who smokes tobacco is going to get cancer or heart disease, but it's a risk factor. And the same thing the public needs to be aware of and make informed decisions, that if you use marijuana, you have a risk factor of a lot of different things. But one of those symptoms is psychosis. How much of a risk? Up to fivefold. It's a significant risk factor. Up to 11-fold if you're under 19 years old. So people, you know, again, scientists know that and advocates know that, but really most of the medical community is not, they themselves are not aware of. And I've seen that with the opioid prescription epidemic, somehow that the medical community were almost like the last to understand that prescribing high dose opioids to anybody with pain is not a good idea. That needs to be more selective. You know, the medical community came around and you know, promoted safe prescribing, but it took a while. And we're at that point now where we don't have the data that we should. We don't have the awareness in the medical community or the public as we should. And Lori, like you said, I hope it's not the 100 years that it took us for tobacco to be aware of that. Bryn and Lori, you have anything to chime in on that?
Yeah, I believe that there's a shared responsibility, just kind of bouncing off Aubrey, that the cannabis industry and the media and policymakers, they all play a role in shaping how people see marijuana. And without education or regulation or honest warnings, people like me walk into it blindly. And I think the real blame lies in the silence surrounding the risk. And of course, I take responsibility for trying marijuana that night under pressure, but how was I supposed to know what was going to happen next? I didn't know I was being given a dangerous amount of THC potency. My friend, who is a regular user, probably didn't know violence could come from this either. I'll never know what his intentions were, but to prevent similar scenarios from happening to other people, like Aubrey, I'm going to keep sharing this story to try to save others from happening to them, especially the young kids, because of their young brains, that they have more, they're more at risk for the dangerous outcomes of THC.
Yeah. Lori?
You know, we're just trying to keep things together all the time, but unfortunately the damage is done and it can't be undone. But the bravery and the eloquence of Bryn being able to even talk about this, because I think the majority of people that this happened to, they're either dead or their brains are fried and they can't even speak about it. They don't want to speak about it. They're embarrassed, or they're in a psych ward. Or, I mean, this is a rare thing here that she is even able to do this. And I just give her so much credit. But like I said, when she was born, Bryn's stronger than all of us. So, you know, it she's been like this her whole life. She just kept fighting ahead, forging ahead.
Yes. And again, Lori, you're a good mom advocate, but I completely agree. I mean, it takes bravery, strength, and you have this eloquence and you're giving a description. You're really, you know, for the medical books of what could happen in every parts of your life, right? Even in living in Illinois when this was not acceptable, then you follow the rules. But when you went to California where it's normalized, then you want to be, even you said as a little girl, you want to be normal like everybody else. So that's what happened in California where that was normal. And then your story about, okay, you could use it once, nothing happened. But then you use it one time and boom, you know, terrible, horrific violence that is unthinkable. And being able, we have to all admire you for being able to do that. Let's turn a little bit just to conclude in the future. Bryn, what are you hoping to do? Are you living still one day at a time? And
I'm definitely living one day at a time and just trusting God with whatever plans he has for me. Because I can only control so many things in my life, and that I have to leave the rest of it to him for the following things I'm dealing with. So just doing the best I can, taking care of myself and spending time with my close ones and my family, friends, and just trying to be grateful for each day that I have and filling my days with purpose and gratitude.
That's beautiful. I know that you have a passion for audiology. Are you hoping to get back to that?
That is a goal. I'm involved in audiology licensing legal matter right now, and the trial for it is actually in 2 weeks. So everything's going to be brought up again, and they're trying to protect the public and we're trying to say I'm not a danger to society. And it's just, they got to bring up all the evidence again. So it's kind of almost like another mini trial. And then depending on what happens with the licensing outcome in California, then I'll be able to proceed with the next steps. But I can't even think that far ahead because I can't. I don't know what's going to come from it. Yeah. But thankfully, I've been volunteering at an audiology clinic to get back into the clinic side of things. So I'm really quite grateful for that. And I'm also working part-time minimum wage retail job. And then just following all my probation orders, doing all the things that I need to do, and just spreading awareness and educating as much as I can about cannabis induced psychosis. And I'm also preparing for a couple conferences I'll be speaking at. So those are the things I can control, and that's what I'm going to keep doing. But if audiology is in my future, awesome. If it's not, then I'm going to move. I don't know. I don't know.
Interesting. I think you need to write a book about your story. maybe that'll happen. I really, really want to thank you guys all. Aubrey for arranging and facilitating this, and Bryn again. I agree with everything your mom said. You're brave and eloquent and you're educating, and we really appreciate that. And Lori, again, what a wonderful supportive mom you are. I love that. And I love the fact that, you know, getting support from your mom doesn't end at any age. Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing this podcast. And hopefully
it'll reach somebody.
Yeah.
Whether it's a professional, whether it's a parent, whether it's a teenager, hopefully somebody will listen to this and apply it somewhere in their lives.
Yeah, Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.